Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we have Tony Michaels on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, A Fire in Their Hearts, Yiddish Socialists in New York. Truth be told, the book is not exactly new. It came out in 2005, but the paperback edition has just been released. So when I got the catalog from Harvard University Press and saw that this was the case, I decided to treat myself to a book and a topic that I have long been interested in. I was a fan of the so-called New York intellectuals, and I always wondered where they came from. Many of them were of Jewish descent, and as the name implies, most all of them were from New York. I suspected that they had their roots in Jewish socialism in New York in the late 19th and early 20th century, in that I was not wrong. Tony has filled in a lot of blanks for me in describing the origins of Yiddish socialism in New York and the importance that it had for American intellectual history, and also, of course, labor history in the United States and the history of socialism. I really enjoyed talking to Tony today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
You're up in Wisconsin, is that right?
Yes, yes.
And how,
in Madison.
How are things in Wisconsin?
We've gotten above freezing, so things are looking bright.
Yeah, that's what we say here in Iowa too. Above freezing,
oh, right.
Is a good day. You know, that's great. I should tell our listeners that we have Tony Michaels on the show today. You know, Tony, I didn't ask you how you pronounce your last name.
It's Michaels. That's
Michaels.
Right.
That's great. I got it right.
Yeah.
Tony Michaels on the show, and we're going to be talking about his terrific new book, A Fire in Their Hearts: Yiddish Socialists in New York. I told Tony in the pre-interview that although this show is called New Books in History, I decided to treat myself to this book, which actually came out in 2005. Is that right, Tony?
That's right.
That's right. Because it's a pet interest of mine. It's something I've followed pretty closely for quite a number of years. And when I saw it in the catalog, I said, you know, I got to talk to this guy. I don't care if it's a new book or not. So I'm sure that our listeners will enjoy this interview as much as I will. So let me begin by asking you, Tony, to say a few words about yourself, that is, where you were from, where you went to school, and how you became interested in history.
Okay. I just want to interject that actually it just came out in paperback last month,
sense
it's new in that sense.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, yes, it came out in 2005. So I come from California, the Bay Area, which is hardly a hotbed of Yiddish socialism. I grew up in Silicon Valley and then went to college at UC Santa Cruz,
mm-hmm.
and then graduate school at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't exactly recall how I got into the subject. I feel like I stumbled into it through a series of decisions that, well, I don't even know if decisions is the right word. I think I felt like I just kind of gravitated towards it. And I was interested in history, disparate things, history of socialism, history of Jews. And those disparate interests converged in this subject at some point in graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then who was your advisor as an undergraduate? Did someone guide you in this direction, or was it just an accident?
No, not at all. And there was no Jewish studies program at the time at UC Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do much coursework in that. I didn't have much training in it. I didn't have any advisor guiding me in this direction. I had certainly had professors that were took an interest in me and had an influence on me. But as far as the subject goes, that was something I gravitated to kind of on my own. When I got to graduate school, that was different, of course.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to Yiddish is not the first language that people generally pick up, at least here in Iowa, and I bet the same is true in Wisconsin. How did you come to learn Yiddish?
That's true. Well, you know, the first, I would have taken Yiddish, I think, if we were offered at Santa Cruz, just
mm-hmm.
because I think I had an emotional predisposition to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I started learning it in graduate school. It was the first week of the semester of my first year, and my advisor at the time said, you know, do you know Yiddish? I said, no. And he said, well, it's time you start learning. So that's how I got into it. It was being offered at Stanford, and
mm-hmm.
my advisor said I should take it. And I actually took to it very quickly and fell in love with it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I don't I read German. I don't read Yiddish because I don't know Hebrew characters. But I was very interested in the book to see the transliterated words and try to find their German equivalent if they had one. So it's something I'm very interested in. And obviously we have all these Yiddish expressions in English. So it must have been a fascinating thing. I mean, it's very good that you could learn it at Stanford. That's terrific. I don't think we have anyone here that does it, but it's something that it's something that I've always had a kind of interest in it. I don't exactly know why. But so then, did you go to graduate school intending to study labor history or socialist history?
Well, I can't say I thought about graduate school very clearly, for better or for worse. But I knew I was interested in socialist and labor history. And I knew I was also interested in Jewish history. In fact, there was a Jewish history program in the history department, and that's what I applied to.
I see.
So I knew I wanted to study some aspect of socialism, working class history, and Jews. And I just didn't know exactly how I was going to do it or what topic I was going to pursue. Those things I didn't know.
I see. Well, it's good to go into things with an open mind. Actually, your story is almost as accidental as mine. I went to college to play basketball, and they assigned me a guy who was a Russian historian as my advisor. And that was pretty much it. You know, I was from Kansas. I don't have any Russian background or anything. It was a complete accident on my part. But so let's launch into a discussion of the book itself. And I want to begin with a question which I don't know the answer to. But it slightly precedes the period which you discuss in A Fire in Their Hearts, and that is, tell us a little bit about the initial Jewish immigration to New York in the 19th century. Who were the first Jews to come there?
Jews had been coming to New York since the 17th century, before it was New York, when it was New Amsterdam. But after the Civil War, increasingly large numbers of Jews started coming from Eastern Europe, mainly the Russian Empire, but also Austria-Hungary and Romania. And their numbers grew very quickly, so that by the 1890s, the Lower East Side was already being referred to as the Jewish Ghetto, or the Great Jewish Ghetto, or Jewtown, in the words of Jacob Riis. And by World War One, actually a little bit earlier, there were more than 500,000 Jews living in the Lower East Side alone. So it became, within a short time frame, from the Civil War to World War One, the city as a whole became home to well over a million Jews. Actually, I wish I had the numbers at my fingertips. I think it was about 1.5 million Jews. And that became the single largest Jewish urban community in the world. There was no other place came close.
Yeah. So these Jews from Eastern Europe were predominantly Yiddish speakers then?
Yes, they were predominantly Yiddish speakers. That's right.
I see. So the area of the Lower East Side, which we now associate with that Jewish immigration, had a prior immigration. I knew a little bit about it, but you flesh it out much better in your book. And that is, these were Germans who had come here. Maybe you can talk a little bit about them.
Well, there was a large German immigrant community, most of whom were not Jews, but Protestants or Catholics. Although there was a Jewish component in that immigration as well. And the bulk of them had settled on the Lower East Side. And it was known for that reason as Klein Deutschland, or Little Germany. And they really put a German stamp, in the area known as the Lower East Side at the time. And one thing they brought to the United States, it's important for my book, is a strong socialist and labor tradition and institutions. And so that Germans were really the backbone of American socialism during the second half of the 19th century, let's say. And Jews coming to the Lower East Side encountered an area that was predominantly German, and that was obvious in lots of ways. German signage on businesses, saloons, beer halls, theater, lecture halls, and all sorts of ways you'd see German and German coworkers, and on and on.
No, this is the part of the book that actually I found most fascinating, and I think is the most revisionist. Can one say that? I don't know, because at least I had this notion that the Jews who came from the Eastern Russian Empire brought socialism with them to the Lower East Side, but you argue something very different. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yes. Well, Jews eventually there would be many Jews who came to New York who did bring socialism with them, of one, you know, socialism of one stripe or another. But for the immigrants who came in the period between, let's say, 1870 and 1890, they did not, for the most part. They had no, the vast majority of immigrants had no political affiliation or experience or exposure to socialist ideas whatsoever. And that's because there was no movement, a socialist movement among Jews that emerged, had emerged yet in Russia. That wouldn't happen until after 1900, really. There were groupings that appeared in the 1890s, but it wouldn't become a mass movement there mm-hmm. so much later. So people, what had happened is that people, future observers would confuse a later development with an earlier development. Mm-hmm. They'd confuse the later immigrants who did bring over one another form of socialism as the experience of all immigrant Jews. So those mm-hmm. who were coming in the late 19th century didn't bring that with them. Mm-hmm. And they discovered, for many of them, they discovered it in the United States. Mm-hmm. The people who, the founders of the Jewish, what was called the Jewish labor movement in New York, the founders of that movement, most of whom were actually intellectuals. And those intellectuals, which is really to say students, those intellectuals did have sympathy with the revolutionary movement in Russia. They had some exposure to it, although their ideas about revolution and what socialism meant were very vague and unformed at the time. But that was the element that had some exposure, but the numbers were relatively small. And they came to the United States and would eventually become founders of the Jewish workers' movement, even though very few of them were actually workers mm-hmm. for any length of time. So what I discuss in my book is the interactions between those early Jewish immigrants, especially the intellectuals, and the German radicals, the socialists and the anarchists on the Lower East Side, in that encounter that took place in the 1880s. And as I try to argue, that encounter between Russian Jew Russian Jewish radical or would-be radical and German socialists and anarchists would lead directly to the creation of the Jewish workers' movement. Mm-hmm. The intellectuals, like I said, already had a kind of political consciousness, but they didn't know a whole lot about Marxism or social democracy or anarchism. And they learned that. They picked up those new ideas, ideologies from the Germans in New York. They also borrowed a lot from Germans in other ways. Germans, especially German socialists, set up models of organization that were completely alien to the Russian Jews, such as trade unions. Mm-hmm. Forming unions, participating in election campaigns, those sorts of things were new. They were alien, and at first, for many of these Russian Jews, they were they seemed very mundane, because the idea of revolution is throwing a bomb, basically, yeah. and assassinating the Tsar. Yeah. So, you know, the idea of standing on a street corner handing out leaflets or something like that just seemed just too mundane and unworthy of the idea of revolution. So what Germans did is basically teach them a new conception that said, you know, no, you can be a revolutionary, but you also have to engage in practical work to change society, and that can be done in a democratic society like America. You can organize unions, take part in election campaigns, propagate socialist ideas, and the proper socialist ideas, of course, were either Marxism or some form of anarchism. And once Jewish radicals accepted that idea, they started following the German model in creating mm-hmm. the foundation for the Jewish labor movement, in which they started to propagate socialism in Yiddish mm-hmm. to the immigrant masses who had never before encountered Yiddish, encountered socialism in any language. Mm-hmm. So there's a process of three-way process of transmission that went from Germans in America to a small number of Russian Jewish radicals who were just discovering new forms of socialism from the Germans in New York, and then those Jewish radicals transmitting socialism in Yiddish to the immigrant masses.
The German Social Democratic Party was obviously the most important in Europe at the time, so it's not particularly surprising that these Russian Jewish intellectuals, when they showed up in New York, would have a kind of German orientation. But what did they mm-hmm. think about the Yiddish-speaking Jews mm-hmm. in the New York community at the time? Because there's a kind of class element here as well, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, there was a part of the Rush. Are you, I'm sorry, are you talking about the Russian Jews?
Yeah, the Russian Jews. Yeah, the members of the intelligentsia. Yeah.
Yeah, they had a I think a mix of views. It's hard to know exactly what they felt because they didn't leave detailed explanations at the time. But according to most of their recollections that were published much later, they felt a mix of feelings. One strongly felt impulse was that, well, the mass of Yiddish-speaking immigrant Jews were benighted, they were ignorant. They weren't enlightened yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some sense that they were, uncultured and uneducated and ignorant at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also a strong feeling that Jewish immigrants, the Jews had strong inclinations toward education
mm-hmm.
and towards radicalism. So even though most of the workers were not enlightened yet, they would be soon and they could be fairly easily.
Mm-hmm.
So with enough hard work,
mm-hmm.
Great success could come. So it was a mix of positive and less than flattering sentiments towards most immigrant Jews. I'd say that's the best mm-hmm. way to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was expressed in an ambivalent attitude in the late 19th century toward the Yiddish language itself,
mm-hmm.
Which most educated people in Europe viewed as not really a true language at all, but a corrupted dialect of German.
Mm-hmm.
And that was certainly true of the intellectuals who viewed Russian as the language of their intellectual selves.
Mm-hmm.
And Yiddish was, again, they refer to it as jargon,
mm-hmm.
which can be translated as jargon or maybe a little more neutrally as the Jewish vernacular.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they referred to it, meaning that they didn't see it as a language on par with the major European languages. And yet these very same people embraced Yiddish starting in the 1880s for the very purpose of preaching socialism and trying to educate the workers,
mm-hmm.
and along the way developed more or less positive feelings about Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes those feelings you could describe perhaps as sympathetic condescension or something like that. Which is to say that there was an attitude that yes, Yiddish is not really on par with French, Russian, German, or English,
mm-hmm.
but Yiddish is not such a bad language in its own right and can be put to good uses. And who knew? You know, it's kind of the surprise. This is a kind of condescending sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were those who always viewed it as nothing more than a kind of, as someone, one writer put it, a mishmash sprach. again, a kind of not really a true pure language, but some kind of corrupted hybrid. And then there were those who later came on the scene and came to view Yiddish as not only a useful tool, but an end in its own right,
mm-hmm.
Which is to say the backbone of a new kind of Yiddish, a new kind of culture, new kind of secular culture in the Yiddish language that ideally would be the cultural instrument of the Jews for, you know, in perpetuity.
Yeah.
So initially there was this kind of mix of feelings about Jews and about the language they spoke that eventually gave way to more positive sentiments.
Mm-hmm. Was there at the time any sort of Yiddish literature, say prior to mm-hmm. 1890?
Yes, there was Yiddish, but it was young. Yiddish literature was still very new. Yiddish fiction started emerging in Russia in the 1860s,
mm-hmm.
slowly. There wasn't a whole lot in the way of Yiddish poetry. Yiddish theater had been suppressed in Russia, or in Eastern Europe, so mm-hmm. there wasn't a whole lot of that. There were no Yiddish newspapers to speak of
mm-hmm.
in Russia at the end of the 19th century because they were illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not a strong literary tradition. It was just emerging at the time of the mass immigration. So a lot of the early Yiddish writers in America, including those associated with the socialist movement, were really inventing their own tradition as they went.
Mm-hmm.
That was very different. That's a big contrast with the Germans because, of course, they could draw from a huge body of literature, not just in terms of fiction and poetry, but scholarship, newspapers, political theory, the whole array of knowledge produced in the German language was available to them. And in the case of the Jews, they had to invent things from scratch. They had to improvise. They had to create. They couldn't import newspapers. They had to create them.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what was produced in New York at this time was new, was indigenous to New York, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Or at least as a product of New York. Maybe that's a better way to put it. It's the product of New York, and so you start seeing things such as in the 1880s, the emergence of a new kind of poetry, protest poetry in Yiddish,
mm-hmm.
By groups of individuals who associated with the workers' movement,
mm-hmm.
and they would eventually come to be known as the sweatshop poets.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in that, you know, the kind of poetry they were writing just hadn't been seen before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I find this very interesting in the sense that, again, you have another one of these reversals. I mean, again, we mm-hmm. tended to think of the Jews having carried socialism with them,
mm-hmm.
and that turns out not to be true, that they mm-hmm. they adopted it, molded it, and assimilated it from this pre-existing German community. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, I had interviewed Sam Kassov about his book concerning Emanuel Ringelblum. Yeah,
yeah,
that's an interview on the site if anybody wants to listen to it. It truly is an amazing book. But, you know, and again, I was sort of under the misapprehension that this idea that the Jewish community could subsist in Yiddish and then there could be a Yiddish culture was a kind of thing invented in Poland. And one of the things you point out in the book is that it actually was invented in New York and it was carried across to some extent.
Well, there are two things. I put it slightly differently. I think two things were happening that were distinct but would feed into one another. You had the beginnings of what would come to be known as modern Yiddish culture, secular Yiddish culture, in New York and Chicago and other urban centers. Some of those things were specific to, they were created first in certainly in a significant way in New York. That's mm-hmm. the Yiddish theater, that's the Yiddish press, that's certain kinds of Yiddish literature, such as poetry. Not all Yiddish culture arose from New York. I don't mean to say that.
Yeah, sure.
As I said, the Yiddish novel was already in development, in Russia. So, but a lot of Yiddish cultural production was happening in New York first.
Mm-hmm.
So that Yiddish really was the first, in my opinion, the major Yiddish cultural center prior to World War I.
Mm-hmm.
That's one phenomenon. The other is the emergence of ideologies, that upheld, an ideology of what you could call Yiddish cultural nationalism,
mm-hmm.
That not only, that looked at the, that looked at the flowering of Yiddish culture taking place, and then said, well, this is the beginning of a tremendous cultural renaissance taking place in the Yiddish language, and that this should be the main, that what Jewish socialists need to do is perpetuate and develop this culture to the greatest extent possible
mm-hmm.
in the name of the Jewish nation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, that idea of Yiddish cultural nationalism that I just kind of very briefly sketched, that does originate in Europe, not in the United States.
I see. Uh-huh.
And then is brought to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So what you see then is a reciprocal relationship in which certain things are created in the U.S. and indeed sometimes shipped back to Eastern Europe. So, for instance, socialist Yiddish periodicals were published in New York, were smuggled into Eastern Europe by the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And used by revolutionaries there. That's an example of the way in which there was an exporting of Yiddish print culture connected to socialism that happened, where there's an influence on from New York to Russia. And then in other instances, there was an eastward flow of influence.
Mm-hmm.
And that was certainly the case with ideologies about Yiddish cultural nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
The main figure was someone named Chaim Shatlovsky,
mm-hmm.
who I write about.
Yep.
He was an important figure in the Russian Revolutionary Movement. He was a founder of the Socialist Revolutionary Party. But he's also one of the first Jewish intellectuals to create a synthesis of revolutionary socialism and Jewish nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes to the U.S. in 1904.
And this precedes, as you point out in the book, maybe it does precede the Austro-Marxists who are thinking along the same lines. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, they're taking place about the same time. I think his ideas are being generated a little bit before some of them. It's not entirely clear to me what the exact chronology is, but it does seem clear to me that Shatlovsky is working up his ideas independently of the Austro-Marxists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did they go about actually constructing a Jewish literary language or a Jewish socialist language? They found many, many periodicals. You point them out. Some of them are still around today, like Vorwärts is still around, believe it or not. I was talking to some other – I was talking to another person I interviewed, and he mentioned that Vorwärts was still around. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about the Jewish periodical press as it was invented or sponsored by these socialists.
Well, you mentioned the problem of language, the issue of language in creating a literary Yiddish. That was a big problem. And it was a problem for two reasons. One was that a lot of the intellectuals didn't know Yiddish well when they started writing, or then when they made the decision to start using it. That's either because they had they were born into Russian-speaking families or given Russian educations at a very young age, mm-hmm. and so just didn't know the language too well. Then there were those who knew Yiddish perfectly well, but had left it behind as much as possible as they were becoming adults mm-hmm. and as they were becoming educated. So that there was, so that was one practical problem, was just not knowing the language that well. The other is, even for those who knew the language, there was a problem of how to adapt or how to figure out how to use Yiddish to convey ideas that hadn't previously been conveyed in Yiddish mm-hmm. before. Mm-hmm. So that was another problem. Another problem was that, of course, they were living in the United States, where there was a whole array of new ideas, concepts, phenomena, and so forth that didn't seem to have a vocabulary in Yiddish, at least not immediately, to express. So those were, and I think finally, is there was a lack of or dearth of established literary or journalistic models mm-hmm. From which to draw. So these were the factors contributing to a problem of how to write mm-hmm. in Yiddish, what might be considered authentic or proper Yiddish. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, I left out the most obvious problem, which is that they're different dialects of Yiddish.
Yeah.
So that was yet another one. So what the early socialists did was draw heavily on German. Mm-hmm. Because the vocabulary was there, mm-hmm. and the German language is so intimately associated with socialism anyway, mm-hmm. That it just seemed appropriate to do that. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were those individuals, like I said, who didn't know Yiddish that well, but they might know German quite well. Mm-hmm. So that was easier for them to do. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning period of the late 19th century, you get a heavy Germanized Yiddish in the Yiddish press that a lot of immigrants couldn't really understand too well. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of difficulties reading it and understanding it. And that came to be known in Yiddish as Deutschmarisch, mm-hmm. just means Germanish, mm-hmm. An overly Germanized Yiddish. And eventually, however, and I mean after the turn of the century, you start to see a more natural Yiddish, coming to be used. And again, there's various factors there. One is that people were just learning how to write Yiddish better. You also have newcomers from Russia who are rejecting Deutschmarisch and mm-hmm. a few other factors, so that a better Yiddish starts gradually to come into existence. And people just start developing the tools the mm-hmm. more they do it. Although there's another influence that starts to appear that's not German, and that's English. There's an English influence mm-hmm. on the Yiddish language, too, that comes in. And that would become a subject of great controversy, the extent to which a newspaper like the Vorwärts should use English was a matter of debate. Mm-hmm. How did people actually learn it or learn the language or learn to write it well?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that was exactly my follow-up because, mm-hmm. you know, on the one hand, what we have here is the Hebrew character set and phonemes, not exactly, but the character set at least. So presumably they would learn that in Hebrew school if they went to Hebrew school. But then uh-huh. were there actual literacy schools for Yiddish which would teach them,
It's interesting. It depends on who you're talking about and when they came mm-hmm. to the United States and where they came from in Eastern Europe. But certainly for the intellectuals in that generation from the late 19th century, by and large, there wasn't formal Yiddish instruction, especially too for women. Literacy was greater, not surprisingly, for men. Mm-hmm. For those who didn't know the language at all or knew it very little, they were often tutored by those intellectuals who knew Yiddish. Mm-hmm. So the key figure in this regard, or one of them, is a man named Abraham Kahn, probably the foremost individual in the immigrant Jewish scene, who was the editor of Vorwärts for most of its existence. Mm-hmm. And he used to take his writers, such as Morris Hillquit, the great Socialist Party leader of that time. Hillquit's family name is Hilkovitz, mm-hmm. and he was very involved in the early Yiddish press. And so what Kahn would do is go over their Yiddish with them and say, look, this is not proper Yiddish. This is German. No one's going to understand this. Your syntax is too wooden, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he would sit them down and try to teach them more authentic Yiddish. Some people published primers or a series of articles explaining mm-hmm. what is good Yiddish and what's bad Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
And those were meant mainly for writers, actually. Mm-hmm. The intellectuals. For the ordinary individual, that was a different story. So their problem is not that they couldn't speak it, they could speak it perfectly fluently, it's that they'd never studied it before in religious schools. Religious schools are there to teach boys up to the age of 13 the basics of Judaism based mm-hmm. on the Bible and so forth.
Yep.
So there wasn't, there wasn't instruction of grammar, Yiddish grammar. So what they basically learned by doing, by learning the newspaper, by reading, forcing themselves to read the newspaper,
mm-hmm.
By just practicing, by turning to friends and family for help in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
There were, later on the scene, I'm not sure exactly when, certainly by the second decade of the 20th century, socialists started offering language classes in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
That did start happening. But already, they're several decades into the story by the time those classes get started. There's a proliferation of self-education societies starting in the 1890s where workers were creating their own education societies
mm-hmm.
where people would get together and read, sometimes write, teach themselves how to give a speech or a lecture. So there was an intense atmosphere of self-education that I imagine extended not only from, not that was concerned not only with reading, but also with public speaking, and I'd imagine with writing itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I find it very interesting. This goes back to the influence of the SPD and
mm-hmm.
its culture, because they attempted in Germany to create a kind of socialist culture,
mm-hmm.
and it seems as if that these Russian intellectuals, in creating a kind of Yiddish socialist culture, modeled what they were doing off what was being done in Germany. And I'm particularly speaking about things like these worker circles and the study mm-hmm. circles, the speeches, and also, and this is the part that that I find most mind-blowing, is socialist summer camp, which I know the Germans sort of invented and lasted a very long time into the mid-20th century. I've met people who went to socialist summer camp. So it was an attempt to create a kind of proletarian culture in the Yiddish language among these Yiddish speaking Jews, and in that sense it's a very interesting example of kind of international influence. So they're
mm-hmm.
taking their cues from the Germans and then modeling it and adapting it to the American context, and it shows a really quite considerable degree of persistence in the American context, which I find absolutely fascinating. I wanted to ask you about the relationship between those who wanted to attempt to create a socialist Yiddish-speaking culture and two other ideological currents which must
mm-hmm.
have affected Jews in New York at this time. And one was compulsory education or education in general and movements toward American cultural assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other was those people in the Jewish community who were more religious,
mm-hmm.
who were worried precisely about this kind of assimilation. Maybe
mm-hmm.
you could give us a feel for how the Yiddish socialists dealt with these two forces.
Cultural assimilation and religion?
Yeah, and religion, yeah, exactly.
Well, at first, religion, and when I say at first, again, I'm referring to the 1880s, 1890s,
mm-hmm.
Religion was thought to be a problem. An obstacle to the success of socialism. And this was especially true among anarchists who were really hostile to all forms of religion, including Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So they campaigned pretty vigorously against it. The most famous or infamous example is what was called the Yom Kippur Ball, where Jewish anarchists would hold balls on Yom Kippur, the
mm-hmm.
most holy day in the Jewish calendar,
mm-hmm.
and eat food, celebrate, dance, drink, smoke, whatever. And it was meant as a very provocative anti-religious statement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Socialists had a more tolerant attitude, again, taking their cue from German socialists, who in the 1870s had determined that religion should be a private matter.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, not really the concern of the party. If a religion, if a person wanted to be religious, fine. If not, fine. So the socialists were more tolerant in that regard. They didn't especially like it, but they were tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
And some socialists, such as Abraham Kahn, even used religion, or let's say the idioms of religion, to convey the socialist message.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the anarchists stopped their kind of a more provocative and combative stance. And one reason for that is because religion just really wasn't a threat,
mm-hmm.
Certainly not in New York. There were Orthodox Jews, to be sure. But the Orthodox Jews seemed increasingly irrelevant from mm-hmm. the perspective of the socialists. Their numbers were small. The overall trend among immigrant Jews was towards secularism.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that everyone became atheists or that everybody discarded all aspects of religion. That didn't happen. In fact, a good number of immigrants maintained a mix of attitudes
mm-hmm.
that combined friendliness and attachment to religion, but also an adherence to socialist ideas. Sometimes those people are called half socialists
mm-hmm.
or half orthodox,
mm-hmm.
Things like that. But nonetheless, you know, many people had maintained this kind of mix of feelings and attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have two poles, the diehard orthodox on the one side, the diehard socialists on the other. Theoretically, they can't be reconciled, but in practice, people drew elements from both, and I think socialists eventually got to the point, I don't know when you could date it, but eventually came to recognize and understand that they were the trendsetters, they were the pace setters, not the Orthodox Jews, and that was really a tremendous reversal of status and of values in the Jewish community. So Orthodoxy or Judaism went from being an all-encompassing way of life in Eastern European Jewish life to being a kind of small subculture
mm-hmm.
among New York Jewry, while people who were previously marginal, you know, the radicals and the secularists came to be leaders of a great segment of the world's largest Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
So the there were certainly Orthodox Jews, but the dynamics of power were not working in their favor
mm-hmm.
For a host of reasons. And then you've got the pulls of Americanization. Now that's
yeah.
a difference. Now that's much more powerful,
mm-hmm.
As you can imagine. There's the public school. There's just the entire the larger society.
Mm-hmm.
With its various attractions in terms of things like popular entertainment, sports,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing, and pressures. There were, of course, pressures to assimilate as well. So that was very much a concern among people who were afraid that their children were going to become absorbed into the capitalist ethos.
Mm-hmm.
So for a lot of socialists, that was a concern, that their children would be lost. And the children would lose their connection to the Jewish working class and lose their sympathies to the socialist cause. And then there were those who also felt, particularly those who wanted to create a Yiddish culture, who loved Yiddish and wanted it to survive in America. Those people also looked askance at the public schools because of obviously they were an anglicizing force.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this mix of feelings. This is expressed very strongly. These concerns were expressed very strongly in discussions of the public school, in the American public school. And you had socialists and you had these Yiddishists who had both cause. And, of course, many Yiddishists were socialists, so they had two causes to be concerned about the detrimental influence that public schools might have on their kids. And at the same time, however, they were also impressed with American public schools.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't uniformly hostile by any means. They were very impressed by the idea of universal public education. They considered that extremely progressive, coming from a country like Russia, in which education was a privilege, not a right.
Right.
So there was this mix. You get this ambivalence again towards the larger society that it has these great opportunities, and at the same time might corrupt values.
Mm-hmm.
Political and cultural values. And of course, over the long term, I suppose you could say the forces of Americanization won out, at least in the sense that Yiddish ceased to be the spoken mm-hmm. vernacular, the everyday language of Jews in America. So the Yiddish cultural nationalists clearly lost that one over time. Socialism had greater longevity, I'd argue. The successive generations of Jews, anyway, continued to gravitate or maintain commitments to socialism of one kind or another. And you see that really up until the 1960s.
Yeah.
They didn't always do so as Jews necessarily, mm-hmm. but there was an attraction to the radical left among Jews for quite a long time.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that in a second, but let's just take one step back and introduce a third group,
uh-huh.
and that would be Hebraists or Zionists.
Oh, right.
How did these Yiddish-speaking socialists in New York relate to Zionism and the notion of Hebrew as the Jewish national language?
Now things are really getting complicated.
Yeah.
Separate Hebraism from Zionism to some extent. There was generally a lack of interest, let's say, in Hebrew among the socialists. I'd say indifference to maybe some hostility, but I'd say more indifference. And that's because so few Jews could read Hebrew in America,
mm-hmm.
That the Hebraist movement here was very, very weak.
Mm-hmm.
There were Hebrew writers, most of whom were Zionists, but they didn't have much of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hebrew was never really a threat here to Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a competitor.
Mm-hmm.
So it just didn't warrant a whole lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Zionism is different. Zionism, of course, did Zionism had a lot of followers and therefore was presented a challenge to at least the mainstream socialists. Not in the beginning, though. Zionism didn't really start to become a force until the first two decades of the 20th century. Zionism emerged as a force precisely in response to various crises in Europe, mainly pogroms, anti-Jewish riots.
Mm-hmm.
There was a series of those. And with each round of violence against Jews, the sympathy for Zionism tended to increase.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, Zionism was growing in Eastern Europe, often for the very same reason, and there was an influx of thousands and thousands of Zionists. Now, many of those Zionists were leftists.
Mm-hmm.
They were socialists of one kind or another. Some were Marxists and Zionists. So you start to get these hybrid ideologies proliferating in the first two decades of the 20th century. They combined various forms of Zionism with various forms of socialism. There were even anarchist Zionists during this period, and so you've got this. So now Zionism starts to become a competitor to the established, more orthodox forms of socialism that grew out of the late 19th century. You have more adherents, more mm-hmm. people are getting involved and growing sympathetic to left-wing forms of Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
So that you get a lot of political competition and conflict. As time goes on, you get more and more kinds and varieties of socialists, and Zionists are among them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Let's stir the pot a little bit more,
okay.
And let me ask you about yet another group. That is the Bund, the Jewish labor movement in Eastern Europe, which those of us who went to graduate school, I guess, in the 1980s, 1990s, we learned that the Bund was the largest Jewish socialist group in the world. Yeah. I guess that might not be true now that I've read your book. But in any event, what were the relationships between the Bund on the one hand and the New York-based Yiddish socialists?
It's a great question. The Bundists had a tremendous influence on the pre-existing American Jewish labor movement. The Bundists started arriving in large numbers after 1900, but especially after 1905,
mm-hmm.
When the revolution in Russia collapsed and there was a wave of political repression as well as pogroms. And large numbers, it's not known how many came to the U.S., but it's clear that we're talking about thousands
mm-hmm.
of members of this party came to the U.S. And so they brought an ideology with them. The ideology was a combination of Marxism and cultural, or some people call it diaspora nationalism, which held this, that it said that Jews are, Jews in Russia anyway, form a nation, but they're a nation defined not by territory or by state power, but by their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture is a Yiddish culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that Yiddish culture and the Yiddish language made up Jewish nationality, mm-hmm. substantially. And that the Jewish working class are the standard bearers of Yiddish culture and mm-hmm. should be in the future. And so what they wanted is, on the one hand, to organize Jews separately into a separate Jewish Marxist movement, that was the Bund, and put forward a demand of Yiddish cultural, what they called national cultural autonomy. And at the same time, they wanted Jewish workers to be allied with non-Jewish socialists mm-hmm. and non-Jewish workers. So mm-hmm. they struck a very delicate balance between nationalism and internationalism, to use the terms of the time. Mm-hmm. So these thousands of them brought these ideas to the United States. And on the one hand, in the United States, they really infused the local movement with tremendous energy, personnel. I was talking about lots of now battle-hardened and trained activists and revolutionaries are now in the United States, and mm-hmm. they're bringing skills and determination and energy with them, and would have a noticeable effect on the unions and the increasing strength of the unions, for instance. Mm-hmm. The Bund, Sidney Hillman, the head of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, came from the Bund. David Dubinsky, the future head of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, was a Bundist. Mm-hmm. So those are two examples of their influence. However, a lot of the local, the pre-existing leadership in the Jewish labor movement, again, people like Abraham Kahn, who came in the 1880s, they were suspicious of the Bundists. On the one hand, they were in agreement. They both considered themselves Marxists. The Bundists were Marxists and so on. But there were a couple things they didn't quite like about the Bundists. One is that they brought a real revolutionary fervency to the United States mm-hmm. that the older socialists didn't quite think was appropriate. Mm-hmm. The other controversial issue was that they were staunch adherents of Yiddish, whereas a lot of the older generation wanted Jews to learn English and wanted to culturally assimilate. True, they used Yiddish to organize and educate the workers, but the older generation viewed Yiddish as a temporary instrument. They wanted working class to shift as soon as possible to English so they could be part of the larger American working class and not exist as a separate, you know, subculture within it. But here you have the Bundists arguing for Yiddish and arguing for the permanent future of Yiddish and wanting to develop Yiddish culture and paying a lot of attention also to Jewish communal issues. Mm-hmm. And it was this, so you could say the Bundists were both, in a sense, more Jewish and more radical mm-hmm. politically than the established leadership. And that was a kind of recipe for conflict that would play itself out in America for many years to come.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Before we talk about that, which we'll come mm-hmm. right back to, I want to ask what is kind of a digressive question. Well, is it the case that were the scriptures translated into Yiddish?
Oh, good question.
I don't know. Were they?
Yes, there was, in fact, the Bible was translated into Yiddish, and the first modern Yiddish, or certainly the first modern Yiddish translation of the Bible was done by a poet who went by the pen name Yehoash, mm-hmm. and he had some affiliation with the left. He wasn't a party activist, but, you know, he sort of identified with the stuff we're talking about, and he did over a number of years published his translation. One edition, which I actually own,
really?
Is
wow.
It's in Hebrew and Yiddish. You have the original Hebrew, and next to it you have his uh-huh. Yiddish translation.
Yeah.
Others editions are just the Yiddish. So that does, yes, that there is a translation of the
what
Bible.
What does the Rebbe say about translating the Bible into Yiddish, or into English for that matter? I don't know. Is that an appropriate thing to do? Or
that's a good question.
Would it strike people as kind of sacrilegious? Or
I'd imagine it probably did. I don't know. I don't have any concrete information about how Orthodox Jews reacted to this.
Yeah.
Traditionally, the way it worked in Jewish society was that Yiddish translations, or let's say kind of popularizations of the Bible or other religious texts, were done for women officially.
Mm-hmm.
The language was something like women and men who are like women, meaning
yeah.
men who don't know Hebrew.
Yeah.
So that Yiddish was recognized as an important tool. But always was secondary in importance and in mm-hmm. status to the Holy Tongue.
Mm-hmm.
when Yehoyash published his Yiddish translation of the Bible, I don't know. I could imagine two separate reactions on the part of Orthodox Jews. One is, this is a good thing because it makes scripture available.
Yeah.
Or this is a bad thing because it's somehow sacrilege. I actually don't know the answer. That's just speculation.
I'd never heard of a Yiddish translation of the Bible, and I sort of suspect that if there were to be one, it would come out of this circle.
Exactly.
And in fact, I was right. So let's move back then to the American context. How did the Jewish labor movement, the Yiddish-speaking Jewish labor movement, fit into the broader American progressive labor movement of the early 20th century?
Well, at first, in the late 19th, early 20th century, it didn't fit in all that easily, for a couple reasons. One, because the unions that Jewish workers created were just perennially unstable. They kept on forming unions. Jewish workers kept on going on strike. They often would win the strikes and then create unions, but then the unions would falter and collapse within a year or a number of months or whatever. So much of it was there was a stereotype actually at the time. The Jews the conventional wisdom was that Jews were good strikers but bad trade unionists.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one problem. By the way, the German unions actually did lend a helping hand to the early efforts at unionization among Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Then, starting around 1909, not around 1909, really in 1909, with the famous strike of shirtwaist makers called the Uprising of the 20,000, that launched a series of huge strikes over the next 5 years or so that produced the major garment unions, which I referred to before.
Mm-hmm.
Now Jewish labor was a real organized force.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of, say, the ILGWU, was one of the largest unions in the AFL at the time. So that, starting in this period, the second decade of the 20th century, and probably even more so in the 1920s, Jewish labor was one of the important segments of the larger working class, the larger organized labor movement, no doubt about it. And yet at the same time, because all the Jewish, so-called Jewish unions, which is to say unions that had a Jewish leadership and mm-hmm. was predominantly Jewish membership, all of them really were socialists, socialist mm-hmm. unions, led mm-hmm. by socialists, identified with the Socialist Party, and that was often a source of tension, especially during the 1910s, 1920s, was a source of tension often with the AFL leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Jews were just seen as troublemakers, as rabble-rousers, as leftists. So the standard view in the AFL was something called bread-and-butter unionism, which is to say unions were there to increase the wages of their members, to fight for shorter working hours, to have say over the hiring process, things like that. They were to protect the basic interests of working class. That was called bread and butter unionism. And then the Jewish socialists had a different idea of unionism. For them, unions were supposed to do that, but they were also instruments of social change and social transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And those two views often came into conflict with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And Jews, whereas Germans were the standard bearers of socialism in the late 19th century, by the early mid 20th century, Jews came to be seen as kind of the backbone of the socialist movement. And within the labor movement, they became not the only socialists, but among the sort of paragons of socialism within the AFL.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, because of that, they served to lay the groundwork for the CIO in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of unions Jews had created in the teens would resemble somewhat the great industrial unions of the 1930s, like the United Auto Workers.
Mm-hmm.
So I see them as kind of an important, I see them as an important link
mm-hmm.
between the German socialist unions of the late 19th century and the huge unions of the CIO starting in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. I see. Let's move forward just a little bit. Actually, more than just a little bit. We know in hindsight, of course, that both the attempt to create a Yiddish-Jewish culture in the United States failed, ultimately, if that's not too strong a word, or it passed out of existence, let's put it that way. And then also socialism passed out of existence, at least out of favor among this group of largely East Coast-based Jews. Well, why did those things happen?
Mm. I think those two things happened for a combination of reasons. One cause was political repression. That's just one. And the two major moments of repression was the post-World War I Red Scare and McCarthyism after World War II. Another factor was the openness of the Democratic Party to reformist elements. In particular, during the New Deal Democrats, who started, you know, adopting elements of the Socialist Party platform, so that by 1936, a good number of socialists could plausibly think that the Democratic Party was moving in their direction, that the Democratic Party was becoming a socialist party of sorts. So you can call this then co-optation into the Democratic Party as the Democratic Party became more liberal during the New Deal era. So that was another reason for this, as I say, co-optation. Another was the passing of generations. There was, as American-born Jews started to make it or try to make it economically in America, socialism was had lost its attraction and its hold. There was a great exception to this, and that's the Great Depression. And then you see certainly an upsurge in radicalism among the second generation Jews. But after World War II, of course, there was a great increase in prosperity in the United States, and that seemed to make socialism less appealing and less convincing during that time period. So I'd say those are among the three main factors that affected both Jews and non-Jews in the socialist movement.
Yeah, one thing that I find interesting and something I'd like to hear your opinion about is the hypothesis. I guess it's probably more than a hypothesis that the group that we call the New York intellectuals. These people. I don't know how many of them were Jewish, but I suspect a lot of them. That they are in fact the successors to these socialists. I mean, you know, these people. You know, Alfred Kazan and Sidney Hook and Irving Howe and Richard Hofstadter, and you know, the names just, you know, these are the these are the brightest lights of sort of post-war, well, really 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, the American intellectual scene. What is the relationship between this relatively incoherent group of people, but it's, you know, it's there, and these earlier Yiddish-speaking socialists?
I think there's a fairly close relationship, in as much as many of those individuals who came to be identified with the New York intellectuals came from immigrant homes, in which Alfred, as Alfred Kazin describes, is just part of the way of life in the neighborhoods and where they grew up. So either their many of them were either born into families that were socialists. That was certainly true of Alfred Kazin. His his dad was a socialist, and his sisters were radicals too. Or like Irving Howe in the Bronx, he didn't grow up in a socialist family. His parents weren't socialists, but there was. The socialists sort of define the atmosphere of the neighborhood. So either at the dinner table or on the street, you kind of absorbed it. It was just part of the atmosphere. It was part of the fabric.
Not to suggest a project, but it seems to me that this multi-generation passage of these socialist ideas and their transformation would be very well treated in a kind of prosopography, if that's not a word that nobody understands anymore. That is a sort of intergenerational study that began in the 1880s and then ended in the 1960s, because I suspect that you would find that this was passed from generation to generation more or less directly.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I think that would make a great project. I keep a file. I started keeping a file in case I have if I have the opportunity to work on this more. I think I'd really like to do that. So I keep this file with, you know, it consists of obituaries, you know, memoirs, all sorts of things that that draw out these connections.
Yeah, it's funny because I have a friend, Dan Paris, is his name, and I'm pretty sure that his. He was a Russian historian, actually, and he, I'm sure that his great-grandfather or something immigrated to the Lower East Side, and he had moved back to New York and This was in the 1990s, I guess. And his, I think he tells a story about his grandfather. After he announced to his grandfather that he was moving back to the Lower East Side, his grandfather said, "I spent my whole life trying to get out of that place, and you're moving back." So, you know, I really think that these people, there's a kind of, it's an interesting intergenerational kind of gravity that this place has on sort of intellectually oriented Jews. And I said, Dan Paris is certainly one of the smartest people I know. But I always, you know, when I was growing up, even in places like Kansas, I remember for whatever reason, we would get, my mother was an English teacher, and we would get the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And this just seemed like the strangest thing to me. Mm-hmm. Just the weirdest thing that my mother got this magazine from New York. And mm-hmm. I looked at the names and, you know, it says, you kind of see some of your Daniel Bells and Irving Kristols and these yeah. Norman Podhoretz and these other names mm-hmm. that I kind of grew up with, but, you know, in Kansas of all places. And so I've always had a kind of an envious fascination for this circle. And, you know, your book is a terrific introduction to the kind of origin of that moment in American culture. And I just want to thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. And thank you for saying it.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So we have taken up a huge amount of your time. I could talk forever about this topic, although probably incoherently given the head cold I have. I should say I'm sorry to all our listeners, but I really can't even put a sentence together today. But let me thank you for being on the show, and let me ask you our traditional final question, Tony, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, my current project is really just in its beginning stage, is about, in a sense, it is part two, in that I'm looking at the rise of a large communist movement among Jews, mm-hmm. Starting in the 1920s. And what would emerge is actually tremendous battle between, socialists and communists for the soul of socialism mm-hmm. in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it's a story that begins in the neighborhoods of New York that we've been talking about, but would eventually extend to the international scene during the Cold War mm-hmm. when a number of these unions that I've also been talking about get involved in American foreign policy in some way or another and fighting communism abroad. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be about that, communism and anti-communism in the Jews.
Yeah, no, I so much look forward to reading it, to be honest with you, because again, I just find this multi-generational passage of these yeah. ideas, these intellectuals, just absolutely fascinating, and I'm very happy to hear that you're continuing that work. So Tony Michaels, thank you very much for being on the show. I should tell our listeners that the book is A Fire in Their Hearts, Yiddish Socialists in New York. It's just been released in paperback by Harvard University Press, so rush out to your bookstore and make Tony a rich man.
Marshall, thank you so much. It's really
absolutely.
Been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Tony Michaels about his book, A Fire in Their Hearts, Yiddish Socialists in New York. I'm Marshall Poe, and I have a pretty bad head cold, which is why I sounded so funny today. I hope you have a great week.